Welcome to episode 236 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, September 9th, 2012. I am the Solo Monster. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast. Very much appreciated. I hope everybody's having a good weekend. I read before I started recording here, I read where it was 9 years ago today at the SmackDown tapings that Eddie Guerrero defeated John Cena in their infamous parking lot brawl. I remember that brawl, actually. That was a really good segment with Eddie and Cena. They had a little bit of a feud. I don't think it was ever anything major. I don't know that they ever had any match on pay-per-view. I could be wrong, but I remember that parking lot brawl, and it was pretty brutal stuff, especially by the standards of the types of matches we see today. Obviously, it's a lot more toned down. But that was a hell of a match, and that was 9 years ago at the SmackDown tapings today. It's hard to believe that it's actually going to be 7 years in November since Eddie Guerrero died. I miss Eddie. I do. I miss that guy a lot. And, yeah, 9 years ago today that John Cena lost to Eddie Guerrero in, basically, you know, it was a parking lot brawl, but, it, you know, kind of a false count anywhere type affair, which John Cena would find himself in yet again 9 years later this past week on Monday Night Raw. We'll get to that. Speaking of Raw, why don't we start with that? Episode 1006 of Monday Night Raw from Chicago, Illinois, this past Monday night. Obviously, the hometown of our WWE champion, CM Punk. We had a hot crowd, a really good main event, and a fantastic cliffhanger finish to the show. In fact, this probably would have been a really good two-hour show. But it wasn't 2 hours. It was three. And there was a lot of crap on this show in between all the good stuff. So while the big reveal at the end was actually really well done, I don't know that I can say I really enjoyed too much else on this program. I have a very weird love-hate relationship with Raw right now. It's like that hot girl that you make out with, and things are going real good. She invites you back to her place, and then once you get there, she says, "You know what? I don't feel so good. I think I'm going to call it a night." And much like women, oftentimes with Raw, I'm left shaking my head and not understanding what the hell just happened. So I feel like that's kind of the relationship I have with this TV show here. So the show opened with a video of CM Punk and Jerry Lawler brawling in the back. Punk beat him up, and we were later told that the King was complaining of chest pains, so he ended up not doing commentary on this show. Sheamus came to the ring, started talking about his never-ending feud with Alberto Del Rio, before CM Punk interrupted to a thunderous ovation from the Chicago faithful. He was obviously very much beloved on this show. And anyway, Punk and Sheamus bantered for a bit back and forth. The crowd really did not like Sheamus. It actually reminded me of when Sheamus came out on Raw in Miami the night after WrestleMania. I was there. And, you know, Sheamus had his fans, obviously, here and there. But by and large, he was a hated man for what he did the night before to Daniel Bryan. So Sheamus was not very much well-liked here in Chicago. Anyway, this all ended up with AJ Lee coming out and making two matches for tonight, a champion versus champion match between Punk and Sheamus, and John Cena against Alberto Del Rio, which she later added would be a Falls Count Anywhere match. So those are your two big matches on this show. We had Dolph Ziggler and Randy Orton, who have had some matches of late. They had another one, and not their best match, but it picked up in the end. You know, Dolph actually, he reversed a schoolboy and hooked the tights, got the pin on Randy Orton, so good for him. And after the match, Miz's music played, and I thought maybe he was coming down to confront a beaten Randy Orton who was still at ringside, but in fact, Miz made his way over to the announce booth to join Michael Cole on commentary. Michael Cole had been flying solo up to this point, which you would think would be the worst thing in the world, but to be honest with you, Cole wasn't terrible when he was there by himself. So anyway, Miz came over to join him, and seeing Miz and Cole together, given Cole's history of jizzing his pants whenever Miz would make an appearance, it just terrified me at first. I was hoping they would keep a box of tissues at ringside to clean up the mess, but thankfully, it actually wasn't too bad. In fact, Cole behaved almost the polar opposite of what he used to. You know, when Miz would come out, Cole would stand up, he would go crazy. I know he hasn't really done that in a while, but, you know, Cole was always a fanboy of the Miz, and like a proud papa at ringside, and it really was annoying. But he was actually needling Miz quite a bit here, and it just shows how bipolar the Michael Cole character really is. You know, one minute he's an annoying heel, and the next he's playing the straight man and actually doing a decent job at it. So my advice, pick one role and stick with it. As far as, you know, Miz's performance goes, really, he was no great shakes. I thought it was telling that Jim Ross in his blog this week talked about Miz on commentary. And the biggest compliment he could pay the man was that he looked good on camera. That was basically what Jim Ross said. He didn't say that Miz did a good job of announcing, that he really impressed him with what he had to say. He said Miz likely found out how challenging a job it is to do commentary, but at least he's young and he looked the part. I think that says it all right there. He really was no worse than Jerry Lawler has been of late. I actually wouldn't mind rotating current stars on the roster who aren't doing anything into the role and see how they do. You know? The problem is, and this was the big issue with Miz on this show, is that they may have potential. You know, they may actually be really good in that role, but they're all probably petrified. They're all afraid to say anything that might get them in trouble, a la Abraham Washington. Hence why Miz was kind of boring on this show. He just kind of parroted all of the WWE talking points that you would expect. He's very good at that. Miz is very good at that. But he's also the one guy, maybe with the exception of John Cena being the other, who, when they interview him on someone's DVD documentary, for example, he just comes across as such a goddamn phony. I can't believe a word out of the guy's mouth. You know, anytime I see him on any DVD, it's just so fake. Which just goes to prove my point that it's important that your announcers have some credibility in the eyes of the audience. You know, Jim Ross may not look very youthful. You know, he's 60 years old. He may not even look all that great in HD, given the Bell's palsy, but the fact that he's so damn effective in his role and people think he's genuine, I mean, that's the one thing that really comes across in Ross's commentary. And sometimes he goes over the top with it, I will admit, but he's passionate. It feels real. You know, it feels genuine. It doesn't feel like he's acting. And to me, that trumps whatever negatives may come from his physical appearance. We had another anger management skit with Daniel Bryan and Kane. You may recall that this week they were supposed to show up with anger collages, which they did. Bryan's had yes and no written all over it. Kane's was a blank piece of paper. He then threw the paper into a trash can, raised his arms in the air, and made the trash can burst into flames. This was so stupid. That just ruined the segment for me. They redeemed themselves with the next one, though. They had everyone in a circle do a trust exercise. And the doctor had Kane and Bryan go first, naturally. Bryan was told to fall back and let Kane catch him, which he wasn't all that enthusiastic about doing, but he did it anyway, and wouldn't you know it, Kane actually caught him. And the doctor then wanted them to catch Harold, but they let poor Harold crash to the floor, and they each said that they were starting to understand one another. Always nice to see two people brought together by violence. And when this segment ended, I tweeted that I thought Kane and Bryan were going to be so over as a tag team coming out of this, and I still think they can be, but they kind of went and fucked that all up a little bit later. We had Sin Cara and Rey Mysterio beating Cody Rhodes and Tenzai. I like the Sin Cara-Rey Mysterio combination. I figured that they'll probably end up getting the tag team titles at some point, which I think is a great idea. Plus, I think a match with the two of them against Kofi and Truth would actually be really fun stuff. So I hope they go through with it. It's not like Rey is involved in anything big right now. I know Sin Cara is doing stuff with Cody Rhodes, but keep the two of them together and let Sin Cara get some rub from teaming with Rey. Plus, you're building a history between the two of them, so you know, if you want to do a match at some point with Rey Mysterio against Sin Cara down the road, it'll mean more. I still get emails from people who put together their fantasy WrestleMania cards, and a lot of people seem to like the idea of Rey Mysterio against Sin Cara, which I think we'll see it at some point. I don't know if it'll be WrestleMania next year or somewhere else down the road. But in the meantime, you know, having them as tag team partners, you know, you're forming a relationship between the two of them. You're building a bond. You're building a friendship between these two masked men. So I like that idea. Next up, we had a scheduled champion versus champion match between Sheamus and CM Punk. Yes, the match pitting the WWE champion against the World Heavyweight Champion is not big enough to main event the show. And I will give them a pass this time, you know, given that it was obviously done on purpose to lead into the angle at the end of the show. But even without the angle, I figure they still would have put John Cena in the main event. I do. I really believe that. I mean, just look at most of this year's pay-per-view main events. I think that proves my point. Punk came out in his street clothes and said that since most people likely took the day off because of Labor Day, he was going to do the same, and he walked out. And this did not sit well with the Chicago crowd. If the idea was to do their best to get people to boo this man, that's probably the best thing they could have done, short of having Punk piss all over Road Warrior Hawk's grave or something in Chicago. Backstage, AJ confronted Punk, said that he couldn't leave, and Punk told AJ to check my contract, bro. I found that really funny. Check my contract, bro. He said that he's got personal days, he was using one tonight, then he got into a car and drove off. Somebody else drove off, not him. Matt Stryker showed up, he asked AJ what was going on, what's she gonna do? You know, one half of your co-main event just walked out. And she pretended that she didn't know who Stryker was and then told him to tell Sheamus to stay in the ring. She was going to find him a new opponent. And that menacing new opponent for Sheamus, replacing the WWE champion, mind you, turned out to be Jack Swagger, a man who they pointed out had won all of one match on Raw so far in 2012. And this would not be match number two, as Sheamus beat him using a Texas Cloverleaf submission. Miz actually referred to it as a Texas Cloverleaf on commentary. He used the move's actual name, which I'm sure sent Vince McMahon into a fit backstage. Soon enough, I'm sure we'll have a new name for that move, probably the Irish Cloverleaf, if I had to take a guess. And after the match, Alberto Del Rio attacked Sheamus. He fought back. He went to deliver a bro kick, but Ricardo Rodriguez, doing his best Secret Service impersonation, shoved Del Rio out of the way and took a bullet for his man. He ate a vicious brogue kick that just looked like it absolutely killed the guy. I mean, Ricardo was on the ground. His eyes were kind of open, but they looked glassy. I mean, the way he sold this was just fantastic. The guy looked like he was in great distress, and this was just tremendous. Ricardo was just awesome. I just hope that when he eventually breaks away from Del Rio, it's not a million-dollar man Virgil situation where he gets the Virgil treatment and just kind of flounders as some job guy. I've seen his stuff from FCW. I say let him manage a small stable of guys. You know, let him talk a little bit more. He's actually pretty good at it. He could play the Bobby Heenan role and take all these big bumps for his guys. Although, Heenan fucked up his neck by taking all those crazy bumps over the years, so I wouldn't want the same thing to happen to Ricardo, but I just think he would be very good in that role. Eve Torres against Caitlyn. Diva's stopwatch this week clocked in at 3 minutes 12 seconds. Not that it really matters, since the announcers paid absolutely no attention whatsoever to the match. I don't know what the hell happened with the commentary here. It was a total train wreck. Layla was out there with Miz and Cole, and all Layla and Miz did was bicker back and forth. It actually seemed like Layla was really getting upset with Miz. You would think the two of them were having a champion against champion match at Night of Champions. That's the match they were actually building up here. And no, it's not happening. Eve pinned Caitlyn with a neck breaker, which is odd given that Caitlyn is the one getting a title shot at the pay-per-view. I know the story going around is that Caitlyn accidentally won that horrific Divas Battle Royal a couple of weeks ago. It was actually Eve who was supposed to win, but she fell off the apron and kind of fucked it all up. You know, that may well be true, but you could have done a deal on SmackDown that same week. You know, that at the tapings the next night, you could have rectified that very easily by having Eve beat Caitlyn and getting her title shot. And you didn't do that. So Caitlyn is your number one contender. She should be treated as such. I mean, it's no wonder that people don't give a fuck about these title matches. So afterwards, we had Jack Swagger leaving the building. A panicked AJ tried to stop him from doing so, telling him that, you know, Brock had already left her, and Triple H left, and Chris Jericho left, and now CM Punk left, and now Jack Swagger's gonna leave. And all I could think to myself is, hold on a second. Chris Jericho? Wasn't it AJ who booked Jericho in a match where if he lost, his contract would be terminated? Even Jericho tweeted about this after Raw Monday night, saying the same thing. I don't know if that was written on purpose to show us how much of a whack job and a terrible GM AJ is, or if it was just lazy writing, but that was awfully stupid. I have little sympathy for this woman. Anyway, Swagger told her that he was taking some time off, and really, that's the best thing for him. I do like how after talking about these things on recent Sound Offs, we now have Jerry Lawler off commentary, if only for 2 weeks, and Jack Swagger taking time off to get away from this horrible losing streak. But again, in both cases, it's the right move. I not that I expect Lawler to be gone for good. Obviously, he'll be back on commentary this coming Monday. But I just thought that was kind of, I don't know, a little bit eerie that I had talked about that recently. And, well, what can I say? You know, Swagger, well, what is there to really say? You know, this poor bastard has not had a very good year. And the only way to even attempt to try to rehab this guy is to just get him off television as soon as possible. And whether it's weeks, whether it's probably a couple of months would be best. In the meantime, you could send him down to NXT. You know, he can wrestle down there. As long as he stays off TV and people can try to forget about this awful losing streak. Because the guy has potential. And I don't know what the deal is. I don't know. There's been stories about why he's been booked this way. There were stories that, you know, repeated violations for marijuana, and I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, the guy needs time off, and I'm glad to see that they're finally giving it to his character. We had another anger management segment. Bryan offered Kane a rematch from their SummerSlam match. Kane thanked him, said that he would do his best not to eviscerate him, and it pretty much broke down from there. They started arguing. Dr. Shelby flipped his lid. At this point, he started yelling at them, then he stormed off. And back live in the arena, Michael Cole said it was up to the WWE Universe to choose the stipulation for Kane and Bryan's face-off tonight. You could vote for a singles match, a tag team match where the two would be partners, or you could cast your vote for the two men to hug it out. Yep. I can't imagine why Bruno Sammartino wants nothing to do with today's wrestling. Just, you know, every time I hear WWE reaches out to him and begs him to come in and do the Hall of Fame and do something with them, and he turns them down very, you know, cordially, very nicely, turns them down. I can't imagine, after watching a segment like this, why that would be. Backstage, Matt Stryker asked Del Rio about Ricardo's condition when David Otunga appeared, representing himself as Del Rio's attorney. He said his client had no comment. Later, they showed a tout from Otunga saying that they have decided to pursue legal action against Sheamus. And, you know, this is one of the problems with what I would call the pussification of pro wrestling today. This is one of the many reasons why viewers have turned away. The hardcore stuff is gone, and that's fine. Hardcore wrestling, all that stuff from the Attitude Era. You know, wrestlers will be healthier because of it. I have no problem with that, but Christ, I mean, how many times do we have to hear, I'm gonna sue you if you touch me. I'll sue you for everything you're worth. I mean, that may be fine for Paul Heyman, since he's not a wrestler. He's a smarmy, slimy manager. I'm sorry, he's an agent. He's not a manager. But even with the Heyman stuff, whatever happened to those two lawsuits he supposedly filed against Triple H and WWE? Great job there on the follow-up. You know, we saw this on Impact this week also. Joey Ryan gets clocked by Al Snow, and he immediately starts ranting and raving about how, I'm gonna sue you, I'm gonna sue you. Who gives a shit? People don't watch pro wrestling to see grown men bitch to one another that, oh my God, you touched me, I'm going to sue you. You have an angle where you want to do it once, fine. But they do this shit way too often and nobody cares. I mean, it's boring. It does nothing to entice new viewers and it drives away existing viewers. When did everyone in wrestling grow a vagina? I mean, really, enough with the lawsuits and the threats of lawsuits and my contract says this and my contract says that and I have an ironclad contract. Just fight! David Otunga main evented SmackDown this week against Sheamus. You know my thoughts on David Otunga main eventing shows. He's done it on Raw a bunch of times with John Cena. I'm fine with him doing it on SmackDown. That way, I don't have to watch it. Ryback beat Jinder Mahal. I thought this feud was over, but apparently I was wrong. The Goldberg chants were back in full force on this show, but so were the Feed Me More chants, which is good to see. One of our listeners, Matt, was actually in Chicago and said that Ryback was really over with the crowd. Lots of people chanting for him. His segment on Monday's show also gained a pretty decent number of viewers also. So the Ryback experiment appears to be working. I think the time has come to move on to phase two. Beating random jobbers every week is going to get old really fast. Actually, I think it already has gotten old. So now is the time to shit or get off the pot with Ryback. You've invested all this time in getting him over to this point. They've clearly got something with him. They have big plans for him. They've just been very hesitant to move him up to that next level. He's not the best worker on the roster. He may even be a bit reckless, as we saw when he nearly paralyzed poor Jack Swagger a couple weeks ago. But I think they should push him because this show is begging for something different. And Ryback certainly qualifies as something different. You know, we don't see big guys like Ryback too often anymore. At one time, that was the norm in wrestling. Everybody looked like Ryback. In fact, Ryback would probably not even look all that impressive compared to some of the other big men that they used to have, because Ryback, while he is very thick and very powerful, Ryback is not very tall. So, you know, if Ryback were around during the days of Hulk Hogan at his peak and Lex Luger at his peak and guys like that, he'd probably look dwarfed by many of them. But today, we don't have very many people who look like him, so he does stand out. And, you know, people love to make the comparisons to Bill Goldberg, and I can see that, although Goldberg was better than Ryback is at this phase. He also wasn't quite as big, and Goldberg was also more agile. I mean, hell, I remember when Goldberg used to bust out a backflip out of nowhere, a standing backflip in the middle of a match just to show off. And he also had a certain explosiveness that Ryback kind of has. You know, he kind of has that. But I think they should borrow a page from the Goldberg playbook, since everybody's already chanting Goldberg's name anyway. Goldberg beat nobodies and a few lower-level somebodies before finally getting to Raven. And when Goldberg got to Raven, it was a very big deal. You know, that match with Raven on Nitro back in 1998, I mean, that was the very first Match Anatomy I did on this Sound Off. When I started doing the Match Anatomy segments, which I haven't done in a while. But the first one I did back on episode 191 was for that match. And that match had a main event, pay-per-view, big-time feel. Now, granted, Goldberg was a lot more over than Ryback is, but it's not really that fair to compare because wrestling was so much hotter during that period. You know, and WCW was on top, beating WWE every single week. But when Goldberg speared Raven in that match, the roof came off the place. And when he beat him to become the new United States champion, back when that actually meant something, it was huge. It was a big deal. I think the best opponent right now for Ryback would be The Miz. And the best thing they could do is build to him beating Miz to win the Intercontinental title. I mean, think back to 1988. A time when another big, jacked-up dude who wasn't necessarily the best wrestler, but was over with the audience, won the Intercontinental title. That, of course, was the Ultimate Warrior, who beat the Honky Tonk Man at SummerSlam in 30 seconds to win the belt. And Honky was a great heel. You know, people were just dying to see him drop the strap. He had it, I think, at that point for like 15 months, which is still a record that stands today. You know, people wanted to see him get his ass kicked. Unfortunately, Miz has only had the title for about a month and a half, so I think he needs a little more time with it and a few solid victories to help rehab him a bit. Because since he won the title, he's been treated like shit. I mean, it's kind of funny for me to sit here and say, well, the Intercontinental Champion, he needs to be rehabbed. And it almost doesn't make any sense, but just take a look at the way he's been booked. I mean, I know he beat Rey Mysterio at SummerSlam, but really, what else has Miz done? You know, it's not like it was back in 88 when the champions were protected because they were, you know, champions. What a concept. You could start the angle now, have Miz talk trash about Ryback. This actually would have been a good week to start with that, with Miz out there on commentary. He could have been particularly harsh on Ryback during his match with Jinder Mahal, and it just kind of built from there. The key is to not have them touch, but make it so that people really want to see Ryback kill this dude. It's pretty easy to hate The Miz, so I don't think that would be very hard for him to play the role of, you know, cocky, arrogant prick. And ultimately, whether it's 2 months down the road or 3 months down the road, maybe even it's Survivor Series. The key is that it can't be a long match. Miz can get some offense in. He is, after all, a former WWE champion. But you can't book this to be a 10, 12, 15-minute match without making Ryback look bad. He can take some abuse, and then he just has to dominate Miz. Make a statement. Kill him. Get the pin, win the title. You know, in a lot of ways, it would be like the Chris Jericho-Bill Goldberg feud that never was in WCW, because Goldberg didn't want to work with Jericho because he felt he was too small. You know, this could almost be like a modern-day version of that. That's what I would do with the guy. And who knows, maybe by accident, it actually helps make the Intercontinental title feel special again. Cody Rhodes had been doing a decent job of that before they took the title off him, and they've done nothing with it since. Daniel Bryan came out to a massive reaction. Every time he comes out to a pop like that, I smile. It's just awesome. Kane came out. We got the results of the Raw Active Poll. 55% of you voted to see Bryan and Kane hug it out instead of wrestle or tag with each other. Kane was bleeding from underneath his mask throughout this entire thing. I'm not sure what that was all about. I mean, who bleeds from a hug out? Both men went back and forth. They were unable to hug each other. They just could not bring themselves to do it. And this was actually very entertaining right up until the point that they actually hugged. And then they started to push each other, and then they started fighting. So I guess anger management was just one giant waste of time. Kane tried to kill Bryan by wrapping a chair around his throat and threatening to jump off the top rope, but Bryan got up and nailed Kane with the chair, and then he ran away. So I didn't like the way they ended this, but the stuff with the hug was actually quite amusing. Antonio Cesaro, yes, the United States champion, made what I believe was his very first in-ring appearance on Raw. It's about time. He beat Santino Marella. More comedy crap with the Cobra. This stuff is not funny at all. It's just embarrassing. I just wish they would stop. And we had Zack Ryder beating Heath Slater. How about that? Zack is now 2-0 in his many appearances on Raw. He's on a roll. Vicky Guerrero was out next to air her grievances about AJ. She sat in the ring and waited for her to come out. First, though, she reenacted the Clint Eastwood bit with the empty chair from the Republican National Convention. I didn't think it was possible to be any less funny than Clint Eastwood was with that skit, but WWE, they found a way to prove me wrong. AJ came out. She said that she just got off the phone with the board of directors, who said that she has been acting inappropriately lately. Hard to argue with that. She did, after all, attack Vicky on TV last week. And so they said that she can no longer put her hands on any WWE superstar. She apologized to Vicky, who slapped AJ in the face and then cackled all the way to the back. And this left AJ alone in the ring, who proceeded to have a nervous breakdown. She was screaming. She grabbed a chair. She started beating up Invisible Obama with it in the ring. This girl's crazy. And then again, they all knew that before they hired her as general manager, so really it's their own damn fault. John Cena versus Alberto Del Rio in a Falls Count Anywhere match. These two guys worked their asses off in this match, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. They both took a great deal of abuse. Cena, in particular, took some real punishment. He took a backdrop, almost like a back suplex, maybe it was, through the announce desk at one point. He got folded up like an accordion. I mean, he landed right on that surgically repaired neck. I was shocked he would take a bump like that. In a TV match, but it just goes to prove the point that I made in an editorial that I did for SE Scoops a few months back when Cena celebrated his 10-year anniversary with the company. I think it was at the end of June, and I did a list of his top 10 best matches. I said, I'm going to focus on the positive. Even though John Cena may not be the greatest wrestler in the world, he's had some really, really good matches. So I did a listing of the top 10 best ones, and when you take a look at some of those matches, the parking lot brawl with Eddie that I mentioned earlier, the last man standing match with Umaga, the I Quit match with JBL, the submission match with Randy Orton at Breaking Point. Cena excels in these types of matches. He's a much better brawler than he is a wrestler. And anyway, the match eventually spilled to the backstage area. CM Punk came out of nowhere. He kicked Cena in the head, allowed Del Rio to cover him and get the pin. And Punk then gave Cena a GTS onto the hood of his car, and he got back inside. And Cena's laying on the ground, and as the car rides by, who should stick his bald head out the window? None other than Paul Heyman. Poor Paul. Brock Lesnar quitting. I guess he had to take up a job as a chauffeur. And with that startling revelation, the show fades to black. And that was Raw. That was such a great ending to the show. I mean, the show itself really wasn't all that great overall. But the ending was just really, really good stuff. Just a great cliffhanger to get people to tune in next week and find out what the relationship is between Heyman and Punk. It also means that Heyman has signed a new deal with WWE that will keep him on TV in Lesnar's absence. And that is good news for all of us, because Paul Heyman is fantastic in his role. Of course, this opens up all sorts of possibilities with a Heyman-Punk alliance. You know, Punk did say he was a Paul Heyman guy, so this all does make sense. Now, the question is Heyman going to represent Punk and Punk only? Will he bring other stars into the fold and form some sort of faction? One of our listeners, Gareth, suggested that perhaps Dean Ambrose and Sara Del Rey can join the Heyman alliance, and yeah, that'd certainly be one way of getting two new faces over, though unless Del Rey came in as a valet for Ambrose, I'm not sure why Heyman would care about the Divas division in terms of bringing in a woman, but I'd like for them to keep it simple at first, just keep Heyman with Punk for the time being. I do think guys like Cody and Swagger could benefit from an association with Paul Heyman as well, guys that have recently fallen on hard times. In fact, I think with Swagger going away for a little bit, that would be a great way to bring him back as a killer under the tutelage of Paul Heyman, or if there is some sort of group, he can come in as a heavy for Heyman. Kind of like he was for Michael Cole last year, although that was a comedy angle with Cole and Lawler. But that was the role that Swagger was. Swagger was the trainer for Michael Cole. But for all intents and purposes, he almost served as a bodyguard. Anyway, this was great stuff, and again, it opens up a whole bunch of possibilities, which is cool, because nobody really knows which direction they're going to go in, and I think that's a good thing. There was a guy at ringside dressed as Macho Man Randy Savage during the main event. He got on camera at one point, got some cheers from the fans in the building, and after the show, John Cena came back out and invited him into the ring, which was really cool of him to do, by the way. That was a cool thing for Cena to do. And looking at the guy from behind, because there was video that popped up on YouTube of this Macho Man impersonator. And you look at him from behind, he's doing all the Macho Man poses, all the mannerisms. He's standing on the bottom rope, doing the finger pointing. It was absolutely eerie. I mean, this guy was a dead ringer for Randy Savage. And he's apparently been working on that costume for about 2 years now, and is planning on using it next month for Halloween. He did a fantastic job on it, and it really made me think about all of the colorful characters that we used to have back in the day. You know, Hulk Hogan and the Macho Man, the Ultimate Warrior, the Million Dollar Man, all the way through the Attitude Era. And guys like Stone Cold, The Rock, The Undertaker, Kane. We don't have anybody like that anymore. You know, 20 years from now, will anybody be dressing up as John Cena and Randy Orton? This week, in completely irrelevant wrestling news, Triple H got a haircut. I'm sure you've all heard about this by now. You've seen the photos. TMZ, I guess, quote, broke the news, which I found kind of funny because from what I understand, if you look at that picture of Triple H outside Titan Tower posing with those two fans, and you see the new haircut from, you know, as the story goes, those were not fans. they were planted. And I guess it worked, because the story got picked up, and people made a big deal about it. And the first thing I thought when I saw Triple H with his new do was, Bobby Roode, is that you? Because, boy, he reminded me of Bobby Roode with Bobby Roode's new haircut. I can blame Bobby Roode, actually, for starting this trend. I mean, there's been a lot of guys, actually, that have cut their hair recently. You've got Edge, of course, who cut his hair before WrestleMania. Actually, when we interviewed Edge, as part of Sound Off 212 in Miami, the day before, actually it was the day before he went into the Hall of Fame, was when we did the interviews, and Edge came walking over to us, and at first I didn't recognize the guy. It took me a few seconds for my eyes to adjust, and then I realized, you know, who we were looking at, and it was quite the shock to see Edge with short hair. So, you know, Edge got a haircut, Undertaker shaved his head, CM Punk recently all but shaved his head. So, you know, the days of the really bad hair, like the 80s hair, the mullet. Those days are over. Although I guess Santino Marella has something of like a faux hawk. I don't know what he's got going on there, but anyway, yeah, Triple H got a haircut, and I guess, you know, either he just felt like it or it's his way of trying to make the storyline more realistic in that people will see this because the story was planted. So they wanted people to know about this. So maybe people will see this and they'll say, huh, Triple H, he cut his hair. Maybe he really is retired. Maybe he really isn't coming back. Of course he is. But then again, if Triple H's idea in doing this was to be committed, you know, to the storyline and make people believe that he wasn't coming back, I appreciate guys that go all the way. They go the extra mile here to make things more realistic. But, you know, he could kind of do that by, you know, wearing a cast on his arm, maybe. I couldn't tell in the photo if he was wearing a brace on his arm to sell the broken arm. He certainly didn't do a great job of that the first time. So that kind of would be the first step, I think, if you want people to really believe that your arm is broken and you may not be coming back. You might want to walk around with your arm in a sling, perhaps, if nothing else. But anyway, the other note here, Undertaker and Michelle McCool recently had their first child, a baby girl named Kaya Faith Calloway. So congrats to the new parents, although this is not Undertaker's first kid. I think he has two or three others. I'm just amused by the fact that Undertaker's new baby has the initials KFC. Impact Wrestling from Thursday night. I really enjoyed Impact this week. Lots of great wrestling, a lot of emphasis on the importance of the Bound for Glory series. They move things along with the Aces and Eights stuff without flooding the show with it. There actually wasn't much in the way of Aces and Eights stuff, which was nice because I was getting very sick of it. So it was nice to see them cut back a little bit, aside from the goofy interrogation segments with Aries and Hogan. Austin Aries likes to call himself the greatest man who ever lived. Well, I've seen the movie Taken, and you, sir, are no Liam Neeson. So we had Jeff Hardy and Samoa Joe opening the show. They had an excellent Bound for Glory series match. The crowd was on fire for Jeff Hardy, and I don't know why. You know, they were in the impact zone like they are every week, and Hardy usually is over, but this week was amplified even more so. He was the most over guy in the entire show. He actually won this match by submission. Over Samoa Joe, of all people. Jeff Hardy won by submission. He won with what I think looked like an anaconda vice, although I really couldn't tell. I was just floored that Jeff Hardy won a match by submission. I just can't get over that. I'm pretty sure that's the first time in his career he's ever won a match that way. This was a historic event here on this episode of Impact. And with Joe's loss here, James Storm would get to pick his opponent now in the I guess the semifinals of the series this Sunday at No Surrender. There is a pay-per-view tonight, by the way. We'll get to that rundown in a little bit. And anyway, James Storm would reveal his choice of opponent later on in the show. We had Hulk Hogan and Austin Aries backstage talking about the guy who knocked out Aries with the slapjack last week. Still, nobody has explained to me what the hell a slapjack is. Sounds like something that you would find on the breakfast menu at a diner in Nebraska somewhere. They explained that the guy who attacked Aries was working as part of the ring crew last week, and they had found out who it is. And they were going to take this man hostage and make him talk to find out who's behind Aces and Eights. And Hogan told Aries to make him talk, break his legs, if he had to. So Austin Aries playing the role of Jack Bauer tonight. There was a segment later where Hulk Hogan met with a bunch of tag teams to determine who would get a shot at Daniels and Kazarian's tag titles later in the show. Part of the new Championship Thursdays gimmick that I guess TNA is going to do once every month, separate from Open Fight Night. Robbie E. made his pitch for he and Robbie T. to get the shot. He said they're younger than everybody else in the room. The other teams were Chavo and Hernandez and Kid Cash and Gunner. AJ Styles walked in a little bit late, and Hogan immediately eliminated him. So that'll teach him to be late to a business meeting. In another segment later, Hulk Hogan went back and forth with Kid Cash before eliminating him and Gunner from the running. It was just so surreal for me to see a television segment with Hulk Hogan and Kid Cash. Just really bizarre. Probably the best moment of Kid Cash's career, too, I'm guessing. The highlight of his career. Tara, who made it number one contender to... who was made number one contender, I should say, to Miss Tessmacher's Knockouts title by Brooke Hogan. She beat Gail Kim with the Widow's Peak, and this was fine, way too short. I should probably start busting out the stopwatch for the Knockouts matches as well. We had an in-ring segment with Al Snow calling out Joey Ryan. And Snow told him that he was getting another gut check match. All he had to do was win to earn himself a TNA contract. No judges, no bullshit. Just win and you're in. And of course, Snow told Ryan that he would be his opponent, and Ryan flipped out. He said this wasn't the 90s anymore, and nobody wanted to see Al Snow in spandex. And to be fair, I didn't care to see Al Snow wearing spandex in the 90s either. I just wanted to make that clear. Snow said that was fine. He would gladly whip Ryan's ass in blue jeans. I thought that was a great line. He then smacked Ryan in the face. This is the part where Joey Ryan started crowing about how he was going to sue TNA since he didn't work there. He just got assaulted. He does have a point. I will give him that. But still, enough with the lawsuit bullshit. Speaking of lawsuits, we had Joseph Park Esquire on the phone backstage. There was no way this was going to be a bad show with Joe Park on it. Bully Ray found him. He reassured Joe Park that he was not going to hurt him. He just wanted to find out if his investigating had turned up anything on Aces and Eights. This was another red flag for me that Bully Ray is somehow connected or involved with Aces and Eights in some way. I mean, why else would he care about what Park had discovered? He almost seemed paranoid that perhaps Joe Park had uncovered something he did not want him to uncover. So Joe Park cited attorney-client confidentiality. He said that anything he found out, he would inform Sting and Hulk Hogan, but not Bully Ray. And Ray played it cool. He told him, just watch your back. I know people like this. They could be dangerous. Just watch your back. Speaking of Bully Ray, he has indeed signed a new deal with TNA. It is believed to be a 2-year contract, and this is a good move. This is a great move, actually, for TNA. And I think for Bully, it's the right move. There's no way WWE would have allowed him to be himself, to be the Bully Ray character on TV. And it would have been a huge loss for TNA if he would have left. So, all's well that ends well. Bully Ray is staying put. And things are going pretty well for Ray after he beat Rob Van Dam on this show to advance in the Bound for Glory series, which means adios RVD. He's been eliminated. The finish was great, too. You had Van Dam coming off the top for a frog splash, and Bully caught him in midair with the cutter. So that was good stuff. James Storm came out. He cut a promo. He called out the other three men in the Bound for Glory series. We have our final four. It's Storm, of course, Jeff Hardy, Samoa Joe, and Bully Ray. Storm picked Bully Ray as his opponent for the pay-per-view, which means Hardy and Joe will have a rematch of their match on this show, and I am actually totally fine with that. Backstage, Austin Aries was interrogating Mike. You may be wondering, who the hell is Mike? Well, Mike is the name of the man who attacked Aries last week. They found out his name. They found out, you know, he works for a production company out of New York. And I don't know how they found out all this information, but they did. Aries decided that he was going to torture this man in an effort to get him to talk, and he shoved a pair of pliers in his mouth when Hulk Hogan conveniently walked in. And the Aces and Eights leader suddenly called Hogan on his cell phone, and they made a deal where they would trade Mike back to them in exchange for, and this is their words, not mine, the Arm Breaker. Hulk Hogan wanted the Arm Breaker, the person who attempted to break Austin Aries' arm 2 weeks ago. Hogan demanded that he face the world champion in the ring tonight, not in a title match, but in a fight. And so they made a pact. RVD had a brawl backstage with Magnus, who came up to him, was talking trash, so that sets up a match for the pay-per-view tonight. Meanwhile, Hulk Hogan appeared yet again, probably one too many appearances for Hogan on this show. He's very good in his role as the authority figure, but I don't need to see Hogan in every other segment on the show. Actually, somebody like Hogan, it's probably best to not even have him on every show. You know, you save him as a special attraction. I mean, he's a regular character, so he can't be a special attraction per se. But, you know, look at Sting. Sting wasn't anywhere on the show tonight. And I don't know if that was because, you know, if that was by design, if he just asked for the week off. But that's actually a good thing. These guys, Hogan, Sting, they don't have to be on every single show. So anyway, Hogan was on his cell phone yet again, this time with Nick. And I presume it was Nasty Nick Hogan. And if so, I hope he wasn't talking on his cell phone while driving. And Hogan chose Chavo and Hernandez to face Daniels and Kazarian, much to the dismay of the Guido and the walking steroid. They had a great tag team match, almost 15 minutes long. You could see why they put Hernandez with Chavo, because the guy is still really rough around the edges. He's a talented guy. You know, he does that big dive outside the ring. There's not too many guys his size who could pull that off, but I cringe when he does it, because he just looks like he's completely out of control when he does that. Hopefully working with somebody like Chavo, he'll get better. In the end, Daniels hit Hernandez in the gut with one of the tag belts, and Kaz rolled him up for the pin. I mean, that description doesn't really do the match justice. This really was a very good tag team match. Hogan came out for his 18th appearance on the show, although his first before the live audience, and he announced that at the pay-per-view, Kaz and Daniels would be defending their tag titles against AJ Styles and Kurt Angle. And those four had a kick-ass tag match on pay-per-view a few months ago, but Angle was injured at the house shows this week, so I'm not really sure what he's going to be able to do in the ring tonight at the pay-per-view. I guess we shall see. Main event saw Austin Aries in the ring with Hostage Mike, waiting for the arm breaker to come to the ring. Nobody came out, so Aries decided that the deal was off. He was going to make Mike talk. He was going to make him squeal. And finally, the arm breaker came out. He dragged Mike out of the ring, and then he clobbered him. He clobbered his own man in the head with a hammer to make sure he kept his fat mouth shut. Aries nailed the arm breaker with a tope through the ropes. Action spilled into the ring. They brawled until the show went off the air. So that sets up a brawl between the two at the pay-per-view tonight. A pay-per-view, mind you, that had not one single match announced before this episode of Impact. So the lineup looks like this. You've got Austin Aries and the arm breaker, who, from the looks of it, you look at his body type, and he's a big dude. My guess is that it's Luke Gallows. I guess we'll find out. So that's that. As far as we know, there's no title on the line. I suppose it could turn into a championship match if that's the direction they wanted to go in. I'm still kind of shocked that Austin Aries is still the champion. This close to Bound for Glory. I know the plan originally was to do James Storm and Bobby Roode, but in a lot of ways, James Storm has cooled off a little bit, and I think people have moved beyond that. I think people have moved beyond the whole James Storm, Bobby Roode thing. And that's fine. I mean, Austin Aries got over. Sometimes plans change, but if they're still dead set on doing Storm and Roode so that Roode can finally so Storm can finally beat Roode, because remember, in that cage match at Lockdown earlier in the year, Bobby Roode retained the title. It was kind of a fluky way to win, but the whole idea was ultimately you would build to a match where James Storm did beat his former tag partner and win back the championship. So I guess they could figure something out either on the pay-per-view or maybe Impact the following Thursday if they want to get the title off him. But to me, I would keep the title on Aries, quite frankly, and have him go to the main event at Bound for Glory. You can put him with anybody almost. I mean, James Storm, you could put him with Bully Ray, you could put him with Jeff Hardy. I think any of those would be, just as big as any James Storm Bobby Roode match would be at this point. We have the Bound for Glory semifinals on this show. James Storm will battle Bully Ray. Samoa Joe will take on Jeff Hardy. If I had to make a prediction here, I would say Storm over Bully. Joe probably gets his win back over Jeff Hardy. That's just my guess, being that Jeff Hardy beat him clean with a submission on this show. I could see Joe getting his win back, and you can do James Storm and Samoa Joe. Because the two winners will face one another later on in the show, and they will move on to Bound for Glory to get the title shot. And I would guess if it comes down to Storm and Joe that Storm probably wins, and Storm does go to Bound for Glory to get the title shot. Daniels and Kazarian defend the tag titles against AJ Styles and Kurt Angle. I'm just going to go with Daniels and Kaz in this match, because the last time these two teams faced, at least on pay-per-view, AJ and Kurt won the titles, so to do it again, you could, but to do it again, I don't know. Plus, Kurt is hurt. I don't even know if that'll play into the match. Or how much he'll be able to do. So there's been rumblings that perhaps TNA would like to put the tag titles on Chavo and Hernandez. And you're not going to have Chavo and Hernandez beat AJ and Kurt. You would have them beat Daniels and Kazarian. And really, after the finish in that match on Impact, you can make the argument that Chavo and Hernandez deserve a rematch because they cheated. Hernandez got hit with the championship belt. So I'll go with Daniels and Kaz here. Rob Van Dam and Magnus are in a match. I guess it looks like they're trying to get Magnus over, and RVD is at a point now where, whether he wins or loses, it doesn't matter. It's not like a loss is going to hurt him. So I'd go with Magnus in this match. Zema Ion defends the X Division title against Sanjay Dutt. I presume that Zema will retain as they continue to wait for Jesse Sorensen to return from his injuries. And Miss Tessmacher defends the Knockouts Championship against Tara. And I would presume that Tessmacher retains as well. So that's your lineup for tonight's No Surrender pay-per-view, the last stop on the way to Bound for Glory. and that is tonight. So if you're checking out the TNA pay-per-view, let me know your thoughts. Let me know what you think. All right, let's move on to the shout-outs and mailbag. We actually got some good questions this week. If you have questions, if you have anything to say, really, shout-outs, anything like that, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. First things first, happy belated birthday to Shady Shadfather Wright, one of our listeners. He celebrated a birthday this past Thursday. Mario from Egypt writes in, asking for a shout-out. Says, what's up, Solemonster? You may have heard, WWE is finally coming to Egypt. I'll be there on the 19th of October, and I'm so excited about this. I've always listened to you saying how good the live events are, and finally I get to attend one myself. I'm also happy that I'll meet other Egyptian fans of WWE. So that's cool. Mario very excited to attend what sounds like will be his first WWE event. So I'm sure he'll have a blast. This one comes from Sheaber, fan of the show since episode 120. I was watching the Punk vs. Lawler steel cage match from a few weeks ago, and I realized that despite the blood, steel cage matches have lost their appeal to me. Wasn't the original rule for cage matches the only way to win is to escape the cage by climbing out? When did WWE first start using the cage door as a way to win? Do you feel like a cage match still has the impact that it once had? Of course they don't have the impact they once had. It has nothing to do with blood. I mean, I know I made the comment a few weeks ago that I like my cage matches to have blood. That doesn't mean every single steel cage match has to have blood. I think it adds a certain element to it. I think being in a steel cage, it's realistic to think that you would have blood, but it has nothing to do with that. Cage matches were traditionally used as a way to blow off certain feuds between two men. You know, it's kind of the climax of a big rivalry. You have a series of matches that ultimately lead to two men settling the score inside the cage. That was the end game. That was the whole point. These days, you're more likely to have the cage match as the first match of the feud, building to a straight singles match. You know, Vince Russo had a knack for that shit when he was still writing for TNA. Now you've got these raw active matches on these three-hour shows, and you can let people vote on cage matches, and you're going to see them even more frequently. And it's going to mean less and less each time. The other thing is, people interfere in cage matches all the time. One of the other points of a cage match, traditionally, was to keep people outside and prevent them from interfering in the match. Now, it's shocking if someone doesn't run down to interfere these days or pop up from underneath the ring. Look at Hell in a Cell. They've killed the gimmick. And you knew it was going to happen the minute they decided to give it its own pay-per-view and have multiple cell matches on one show. Now those shows, they only do a fraction of the number of buys that they once did. I mean, as far as your other point, you asked, wasn't the rule for the cage matches always that the first person to escape wins? I'm going to guess that you're probably in your mid to late 20s. You grew up on that era of WWF television because that rule was popularized by the old blue bar cage matches. You know, before that, people could actually win cage matches by pinfall. Not that you couldn't escape the cage, but in WWF, and mostly outside of WWF, like in the NWA, that whole escape the cage to win thing wasn't common at all. In fact, you had a lot of old school people who hated that rule. They thought it was stupid. Some people still do. And there were actually WWF cage matches where people won by escaping through the door. It wasn't that common because it was kind of a shitty, anticlimactic way to win, but it did happen, so this is not some brand new concept. Longtime listener Stewart has a question. Says, at the 1999 SummerSlam, they seemed to be heading for a Stone Cold vs. China match. But then all of a sudden, it turned into a triple threat match with Austin, Triple H, and Mankind. I was wondering, was the triple threat always the plan? Or was the plan Stone Cold vs. China, but they decided against the idea? And in a way, that still doesn't make sense to me, since she became the number one contender. The plan was never to do Austin vs. China. Certainly not in the main event of the second biggest pay-per-view of the year. What Stewart's referring to is a match that took place on Raw about 2 weeks or so before SummerSlam. It was a three-way match between Chyna, Triple H, and The Undertaker to determine the number one contender for the WWF title. Austin interfered in the finish. He attacked Triple H, and he helped Chyna get the victory. Chyna actually pinned Triple H, which made her the number one contender. And it wouldn't surprise me if this was done to test the waters for China's eventual face turn. I mean, after all, it was about a month after this. She was fighting Jeff Jarrett for the Intercontinental belt. More than anything, this was just to get more heat on the Austin Triple H feud. That was the planned main event originally for the pay-per-view, and Helmsley would have won the title. What happened is that they made a deal for Jesse Ventura, who was still actively serving as the governor of the state of Minnesota at the time. Former wrestler, big-time celebrity, they made a deal for Jesse to appear at SummerSlam and serve as the special guest referee for the main event, seeing as how the show was being held in Minnesota. And Jesse actually appeared on Raw that night that China became the number one contender, which is probably the only reason why I even remember that. Because Jesse was on that show. He actually did a promo, and he came out for the main event to do commentary. And I love Jesse Ventura as a commentator, so I remember that show quite fondly. China ended up losing her number one contender status in a match with Mankind, I think the week after. And the SummerSlam match was turned into a triple threat with Austin defending against Triple H and Foley. Now, there are two stories as to why the match was changed from a single to a three-way. One story is that Austin refused to drop the title to Triple H, feeling that he wasn't ready yet or over enough. So he agreed instead to drop the title to his friend, Mick Foley, who in turn would have no issue dropping the belt to Triple H on Raw the next night. So the very definition of a transitional champion is what Mankind was in this situation. Of course, that doesn't explain why Austin was fine doing the job for Triple H 2 months later at No Mercy, which he did. But still, that's one theory. The other story is that because Ventura was going to referee the main event, how can you have the sitting governor raise the hand of the evil bad guy at the end of the match? Forget the fact that for his entire WWF career, Ventura always sided with the heels. He even did the same thing in the very first SummerSlam main event, which he also officiated. He was very partial towards the heels. But now that he was the governor, you have to have him standing tall with the babyface in the end. So if you want to do a title change, or if Austin... I think Austin was hurt and needed some time off. He had a knee injury, if I remember correctly. If you have to switch the title, just throw another babyface in there and put it on him. Then switch it over to Triple H the next night. And that's exactly what they did. I just remember how anticlimactic that finish was with Foley hitting Austin with the double arm DDT, a move that he never beat anybody with. I mean, it was always a setup move for Foley, but it's not like he ever won any big matches with it. And he gets the pin on Stone Cold Steve Austin with a double arm DDT out of nowhere. You know, at first I thought that maybe Jesse botched the finish, because you could see Triple H runs over to break up the pin. He doesn't make it in time. I mean, people were genuinely shocked. And then once they heard Mankind's music and they realized that they had just seen a title change, they all were very happy and they started cheering. I'm all in favor of doing more realistic finishes. You don't always have to hit your finishing move to win a match, but you need to first condition the audience to expect it every now and then. You know, personally, I think it had more to do with them wanting to have Jesse raise the babyface's hand at the end of the match. It's funny because the very next month they had a six-pack challenge for the title. And Austin, who again, was not wrestling at this point, he was nursing an injury. Austin was the guest enforcer for that match. And in the end, they had the biggest babyface in the company count the fall for Triple H, the biggest heel, and basically hand him the title. The difference is that Triple H ate a stunner when the match was over, and Austin celebrated by drinking beer, so, you know, they could get away with doing that. Plus, it set up a match between the two of them for the following month. But more often than not, with celebrities, they don't want them to come off as looking weak, and so they want them standing tall with the baby face in the end. And that would be my guess as far as what happened there. This email is from J.R. Sanders. Says, "Hey, Solomonster, I just started listening to your show. I like the stuff I heard on TV Tracks. Everything you say about the WWE product, I agree with. As for my question, wouldn't it make sense for WWE to turn Randy Orton heel? He was fantastic playing in that role in 2009. The face Randy Orton is stale, boring, and played out. Also, how do you feel about them banning his punt kick?" Well, first of all, Orton has been pretty vocal, I think, about his desire to be a heel again. He's tweeted about it. I think WWE would do it, but reportedly, they are not entirely comfortable having Sheamus as the only real top babyface on the SmackDown brand, so they're kind of hesitant to turn Orton. I mean, if 6 months from now Sheamus has firmly established himself as a top guy, then Orton will be a heel, but they're not there yet. And plus, Orton's about to go off and film a new movie, so maybe that plays a role in it as well. He's going to be, in the next 12 rounds movie. Maybe they don't want him to be a heel. As far as banning the punt kick, I got a similar question this week from Woodrow, one of our longtime listeners, about the angle on SmackDown with banning the bro kick. Woodrow is a neurologist, and he mentioned how, you know, the NFL has also taken steps to prevent headshots. Look, here's the deal with the punt kick or any other kick. If Orton was really hurting people with it, then I'm okay with banning it. But if it was just WWE being overly cautious and not, you know, or not wanting to promote a move like that to kids, then I gotta say, I think that sucks. Banning something like chair shots to the head, I can totally understand. You've got guys who don't put their hands up to protect themselves, and frankly, it's hard to justify that taking a chair and bashing somebody in the head with it is what professional wrestling should be. You know, like, on the outside looking in, I could see where people might look at that and frown upon that. You know, and that's not what pro wrestling should be. It's unique to pro wrestling, and they have the power to change that, and WWE has, and I commend them for it. You don't see chair shots to the head anymore. I mean, you know, there's a lot of other moves that they've banned as well. The most famous of which is probably the pile driver. When was the last time you saw a pile driver used in a WWE match? And I'm not talking about the tombstone. I'm talking about a traditional wrestling pile driver. It's been about a decade since that rule, that unwritten rule, went into effect. Every now and then you'll see it. I think Shawn Michaels may have busted it out in a match with John Cena years ago. Might have been their WrestleMania 23 match, actually. But that's about it. I mean, for God's sake, they wouldn't even let Jerry Lawler use the pile driver, his signature move for almost 40 years now, during his feud last year with Michael Cole. And I would think that if you could trust anybody to safely perform that move, it's Jerry Lawler. But it's their policy, and they would not allow it. You know what? I'm okay with that, too. You're lifting somebody into the air. You know, in theory, you're dropping them on their head. Anything can go wrong. I mean, it's hard to criticize WWE for eliminating that danger, because one wrong move and somebody's in a wheelchair for the rest of their life. The shooting star press was banned for a while also. Evan Bourne had to practically beg, he had to plead with Vince McMahon to let him use the move. And he had to get in the ring and perform it and prove that he could safely execute it. And they acquiesced and they allowed him to use it. Again, a dangerous maneuver to pull off. Anything can happen. But now, you're talking about banning a kick. A kick. What are the two most basic moves in a wrestling match, or in a fight? The punch and the kick. And you're going to ban one of them? I mean, they keep it up. We're not going to see anything but wrestlers hugging it out on TV every week. And given that Kane started bleeding on Monday night, I guess the hug is considered a deadly maneuver now. Better ban that too. No more hugs. But really, I mean, where do you draw the line? If you're going to ban the punt kick, why allow Sheamus to use the bro kick as a finisher? Is that not dangerous? Why allow Zack Ryder to use his broski boot in the corner? Why allow drop kicks? Are they not dangerous? Well, I mean, if John Cena throws one, I suppose they are, and he may get you in the stomach with one. But Orton and Ziggler, you know, they throw some picture-perfect drop kicks right on the chin. Why allow that? Is that fair? The go-to-sleep looks pretty dangerous. A knee to the face? I mean, come on, ban that too. The biggest issue I have with this is that, in its purest form, it may have been Bret Hart who said this, I don't recall, but it's so true. The art of pro wrestling is making it look as realistic as possible without harming a hair on your opponent's head. And I love that. It's so true. That really is what pro wrestling should be, making it look like you're really hurting your opponent and beating the crap out of the other guy, but in reality, you're not doing any harm at all. What's so impressive about going in there and stiffing the other guy and really hurting him, especially if he's not expecting it? I mean, if two big dudes want to go in there and really lay into each other like Sheamus and Tenzai a few weeks ago on SmackDown or almost any classic Japanese wrestling match, that's fine. But if you're going to go in there and really hurt the other guy, either because you're clumsy and you're not a very good worker or because you're a bully, that's not what wrestling is supposed to be. If Randy Orton was punt-kicking people and really injuring them and knocking them silly, then that's wrong and he shouldn't be allowed to use the move. But if he's a safe worker, which I presume he is, you could pull off a move like that and make it look good without hurting the other person. Sheamus can kick somebody in the face like Ricardo on Monday night, and Ricardo can sell it like $1 million and not really get a concussion. If you're safe, then I don't see the need to ban something like a kick to the head. I mean, I think that's dumb. Is it because of the kids? Is it because you're PG? I mean, give me a break. If that's the case, then you ought to ban punches as well. How can you condone, how can you justify punching another man in the face with a closed fist? Isn't that a tad bit hypocritical? Just ban punches while you're at it. Ban all armbar submissions. Because, hell, if two kids happen to be horsing around, little Mario could break little Luigi's arm imitating his favorite wrestler, Alberto Del Rio. So I guess we have to ban that too. Where do you draw the line? When do you reach that point where you just get rid of the damn ring and just have wrestlers show up and make mean faces at each other? These guys are professionals. Just let them do their job. Let's do two more here. This one comes from Troy from California. One's from Arizona. He says, I have an idea that WWE might consider, since we are in an election year, for President of the United States. Well, I hadn't noticed. Since on Raw, we are having a bit of a power struggle between AJ and Vicky on who could be the GM for Raw, I came to think that WWE could do its own election-type angle. They could do debates on the shows about certain topics. They could start doing campaign commercials for each one, doing the whole I am AJ and I approve this message bit. Finally ending it off with the mother of all WWE Universe participation, social networking ploys. Having millions, if not billions, of tweets, touts, and Facebook posts. Hashtag vote AJ, hashtag vote Vicky. Have the fans vote on who they want. I'm not saying this would be a good idea, since most debates on WWE really suck, but so does WWE recently. For one thing, this would totally interact with the WWE fan base, which has been one of their main objectives recently with the whole Raw active thing. What do you think? I actually think it's a pretty good idea. I say why not? It would be a fun thing to do. I mean, we're going to get the social media crap no matter what. And they're going to continue the whole AJ Vicky thing, it would seem. I would imagine ultimately it culminates in a match between the two of them. That's kind of the end game here. But you know what? Again, the WWE comedy stuff is hit or miss. But, you know, to put together some mock campaign advertisements would actually, I think, be kind of amusing. And, you know, yeah, you could certainly have people vote in different ways using Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. So it's a very creative idea that Troy has pitched here. I actually would not be opposed to it. Last email here, this comes from James Henderson from Norwich, England. I've been a fan of the show since episodes in the 170s and absolutely love it. I listen to your show on Mondays at work and really enjoy it. I was hoping to get a shout-out as I am getting married this coming Friday to my girlfriend of 4 years, Sarah. Well, congratulations to James and Sarah. It's very cool. For the first 6 days of our honeymoon, we will be visiting New York, and then we fly on to Antigua. We are planning on doing all the touristy things and have tickets to a Yankees game. Ah, boo! I'd say go to a Mets game, but it probably would be depressing. I'm actually going to a Mets game myself on Tuesday, on September 11th. My first Mets game this season. I'm not sure why I'm even bothering to go. I was invited. So you probably are better off going to a Yankees game, in all honesty. Anyway, he continues here, as a native of New York, as I am, what other things do you suggest getting up to? Thanks again for the podcast. It's awesome. So thank you to James for the kind words. You know, it's kind of weird. People ask me that quite often. People from the UK, actually, have sent me emails quite often asking me, well, if I come to New York, what should I do? And I mean, I've lived in New York my whole life, but sometimes I just draw a blank. Because a lot of the things in New York, being that I live here, I kind of take for granted. But as somebody coming from out of town, I presume you've never been to New York before, probably worth it to check out the Empire State Building. Granted, we did have somebody who was shot dead on the street, actually on Fifth Avenue, just outside the Empire State Building, a couple of weeks ago. But thankfully, that doesn't happen too often, so you should be fine. But the Empire State Building is very cool. I actually was up for the very first time in my life, up by in the observatory on the roof of the Empire State Building a couple of years ago. Actually, it was the night that the Nexus angle, the Nexus invasion angle they did on Raw. That was a three-hour show also. I was up there, and it was very cool. So if you can get into the Empire State Building, check out the observatory. You can buy tickets for that. That's kind of cool. I would check out Central Park, not at night, but during the daytime. It's actually quite beautiful. Biggest park I've ever been in, and very, very cool stuff. So you can check out Central Park. You can check out, they have the American Museum of Natural History, if you're into that sort of thing. There's actually a couple of good museums. Not that I'm a museum buff, but they got the Museum of Natural History. They have the Museum of Sex, if you're into that sort of thing. And really, who isn't? So there's a lot of things like that to do in New York. If you've never been to Times Square, I guess it would be an experience, although I hate people, so particularly around the holidays, you don't want to be in Times Square, for example, if it's Christmas time, because you'll just, you'll be filled with rage and the burning desire to murder somebody. But it's worth checking out if you've never been there before. Times Square, all you see all the lights and all the different stores and all the different places. They have the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum over there and all that good stuff. So that gives you a sense of some of the things to check out when you are in New York. So have fun. And again, congratulations to the new bride and groom. Very cool. That's going to do it for this week. Going to wrap up the mailbag. Again, if you have questions, if you have shout-outs or anything like that, you can email me. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the email address for that. Follow me on Twitter. @Solomonster is my handle on there. We are inching ever so closer to 1,600 followers. Always posting stuff on Twitter, so follow me on there. Friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. That's the official Solomonster Sounds Off profile page. We have a separate fan page that you could like if you would like to. But you can friend me on there. I will approve you. We have, again, very lively debate each and every Monday night during Raw. Big thread that goes on, pay-per-views and all that stuff. I post photos on Facebook that I don't post anywhere else. There's actually some pretty cool photos up there. So friend me on there. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes. It is free. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. It should come right up. You can subscribe. Anytime a new episode goes up, you will be among the first to hear it. So check me out on iTunes. I think that pretty much covers all the key stuff. Raw this upcoming Monday night. Don't forget, Bret the Hitman Hart scheduled to make an appearance. I'm pretty sure he's supposed to be on TV. Although I know they're doing a Pat Patterson appreciation night. Apparently, they've gone on this kick now of doing appreciation nights for people. We had Shawn Michaels appreciation night back in August. We've got Pat Patterson appreciation night in Montreal this Monday. Jim Ross tweeted something that I guess Raw comes to Oklahoma City on October 1st, and they're doing something special for Jim Ross that night. So this will be Pat Patterson appreciation night. I think that's why Bret's being brought in. But my guess, it's Montreal. It'll be the first time Bret Hart is in Montreal, at least at a WWE event since the screw job in 1997. And I usually hate it when they rehash that, but I guess that is kind of a cool thing, Bret kind of coming back to the scene of the crime. So I would expect him to be on the show this Monday night. And I like Bret Hart in small doses. I don't need to see him on TV every week, but it'll be cool to see the Hitman this Monday night. So we'll be back with episode 237 next weekend, and I think that pretty much wraps it up. So until next time, be well, stay safe, have a great week, and we'll see you right back here next time for another Sound Off. Thanks, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.